Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
If people don't start talking about it, I mean, it's going to be too late because we are losing a lot of the island and we need help right now.
When rising waters are stealing away your home. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
The galaxy we live in is on a crash course with Andromeda.
Beep, beep. Yes, you dream about it.
Giraffes don't faint.
No, they don't.
You just go about your life, and you don't notice a thing because it's just you.
Don't be so occupied with what you expect out of it, because that's bad science.
That's sometimes not so easy for somebody to let go.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
What happened?
Tomato sauce hit me in the face.
Interrupt this task.
No, I've got you.
Going to have a new cane or cane. Stand in a position that's not right.
You know, MS is always going to be in your living room. It just shouldn't be in the center of your living room.
On today's show, what's the plan? Even if your village is tiny, moving it proves far more difficult than anticipated. Expecting a baby and facing your biggest fears, and when a doctor tells you you have cancer but your mammogram says you don't. First up, we've all seen maps of cities and regions that might disappear by year X if sea levels rise by a certain degree. It's frightening, but also hard to imagine and seems somehow far removed from our lives right now. Not so for the residents of Tangier Island, Virginia. They are struggling to save this small Chesapeake Bay community from a predicted 4 to 6 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. Carolyn Beeler reports.
To get to Tangier Island this time of year takes some planning. You have to take either the mailboat or a ferry that leaves once a day from a small town on Maryland's eastern shore.
Our cruise will take approximately 1 hour and 15 minutes.
On a sunny afternoon late this summer, I took the ferry. Captain Stephen Thomas has been piloting it for 35 years, and he's got the well-worn jokes to prove it.
We'll be leaving Tangier Island this evening at 4:05. If we miss you today, well, don't worry about it. We're going to be right back here, same time tomorrow.
As the boat pulls into the small harbor on Tangier, you can see crab shacks and piles of cages on the shore to the right. Inland, the island has tidy houses and tidy yards, dotted with white crosses and lined with white picket fences. With few cars on the island, scooters and tourists' golf carts rule the road. In front of one of Tangier's two churches, I met Carolyn Charnock, who's lived all but two of her 72 years on the island.
Well, I'm a housewife, but I used to help my husband in the seafood business, but he passed away, and so retired, I guess you could call me now.
Not long before Charnock was born, the last islanders who lived on the upper half of the island moved to the lower half, as erosion overtook their land and turned streets into marshes. Today, fewer than 500 people live on all of Tangier. That's only about a third of the population a century ago. Many who are left still bear the last names of the original families who settled the islands in the 17th century.
Crockett's, Parks, Pruitt's, the main three.
And most speak with the unique Tangier accent, a holdover from those last British settlers.
They say Cornwall, England. So you can understand me, right?
It took me a second, but...
Yeah, I can definitely understand you.
Like just about everyone else I spoke to on Tangier, Charnock pointed to erosion and flooding as the island's biggest threats. During nor'easters, she says stormwaters flood the streets.
It's amazing, really. It's such a difference from what it is now. But it has been known to cover this whole road here.
This road here right in front of the church?
Uh-huh, it has.
So are there parts of the island that don't exist anymore?
Oh, yes, on the western side of the island. When I used to go to the beach when I was a young girl, now it's in the water.
The eastern seaboard is sinking due to an effect scientists call a glacial rebound. A combination of that sinking and sea levels rising has Tangier in trouble. Experts predict the island will be completely covered in water in the next 50 to 100 years. Many residents I talked to didn't believe in sea level rise. They agree they have a problem, they just attribute it to the erosion that's been eating away at Tangier for as long as anyone can remember. James Uker Eskridge is a waterman and mayor of the island.
We don't have any protection. I mean, the island itself is only 3 or 4 feet above sea level.
and it's just soft material sod, and I don't believe the erosion has increased. It's just, it's been going on since Captain John Smith came up to bay, but when it gets to your doorstep, you pay more attention to it.
While there are disagreements about the causes of the island disappearing, everyone agrees Tangier needs help. The Army Corps of Engineers built a seawall about 25 years ago that protects the island's airstrip and sewage system on the west side. Now it's planning a stone jetty to shield the harbor from wave damage. The project was approved way back in 1996, but money for the $4 million project wasn't appropriated until after Superstorm Sandy. The Army Corps hopes to start building the jetty within the next 2 years, but Mayor Eskridge says he knows it's not going to be enough.
We have nothing really going on the east side of the island to protect us. And whenever we get tropical systems, hurricanes or tropical storms, that's where the wind will be on the east side.
We really need a seawall the whole way around the island.
That's Mark Crockett, a crab fisherman turned ferry captain who I met at the Tangier Oil Company. The Barn Red gas station and store is a hangout spot for island men.
Got grandkids living here, you know. I ain't gonna probably be here much longer, but they're coming along. I wanted to be here for them.
Sitting on a bench outside the oil company building, Norwood Evans also spoke of the need to fortify.
It's so much washing away from here, it's unreal how quick it's going.
Evans moved to Tangier from the only other inhabited island left on the Chesapeake Bay, and he can't imagine living anywhere else.
I love living on this little island. I mean, you know everybody and all, and it's a unique place, and the stuff that I love to do for sport is like fishing and hunting and all, and it's no place like it on Earth, I don't think.
The problem in securing the future of the island for Evans and Crockett's descendants is money. The Army Corps of Engineers has proposed breakwaters off the western shore of the island to prevent more erosion, but neither the feds nor local partners have stepped in to fund the project. And as more communities start to plan for sea level rise, Eastern Shore Regional Planner Curtis Smith said the competition for funds to lift houses and armor shorelines is getting fierce.
It definitely seems like there's more localities competing for the funds, and it's harder for rural, small localities like the ones that we work with on the Eastern Shore to compete for those funds.
Smith says tiny towns don't have the staff to work on grant applications, and it's harder for them to raise matching funds needed for many federal projects.
The largest town we have is less than 4,000 people, and the majority of the towns in my region are less than 1,000 people. And, you know, we're competing against New York and New Orleans and Miami, and it's definitely an uphill battle.
While Tangier's future is uncertain, it's at least getting more attention than other towns that don't have the same quaint tourist appeal and historic designations. Skip Stiles is head of the Norfolk, Virginia-based conservation group Wetlands Watch. He points to Saxis. It's a town connected to the Eastern Shore that juts out into the bay east of Tangier.
So you've got Tangier and Saxis, two communities on the bay that are being inundated, about the same size. One gets a $4 million seawall and the other doesn't. How did we make that decision? How should we make those decisions?
As we begin to answer these tough questions for the first time, Stiles argues conflict is inevitable. Fortifying an island that computer models show will be completely underwater within a lifetime may seem like a waste to some. But if it's your home you're trying to protect, buying time and hedging your bets against the rising seas is understandable.
If I'm living in Kansas, it probably makes a lot of sense to simply pull the plug and pay people to move off of the island. If I'm on Tangier and I've been there since the first ships arrived, it's a much more difficult decision.
It's a difficult decision Tangier is facing now and many others will face soon. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
We're going to move on now to another community threatened by rising seas. There, things have already progressed to much more dramatic levels. Alana Samuels is a staff writer for The Atlantic. She recently wrote The Village That Will Be Swept Away, an article about Nutok, Alaska. That community is trapped between two rivers that claim more of their land every year, and it's also trapped by a lack of money. Alana, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Describe Nutok, Alaska. The population is 350 people. Who lives there? What is it like?
It's a really fascinating place. You have the Delta in Alaska, which is really the far west side of Alaska. And you have all these tiny native Alaska villages, you know, people that have lived there for centuries, if not longer. And you can't get to any of these villages except for by an airplane. These little propeller planes go there a couple times a day and drop off mail and supplies. So there are all these tiny little villages that don't have any roads in or out and are really sinking as sea levels rise.
Describe exactly how climate change is threatening the community in Nutok.
There are a few things that are going on. One of them is that permafrost is melting. So permafrost is this thing that's unique to Arctic regions, and it's basically permanently frozen soil. And that's provided a bedrock for a lot of these communities. But as it melts and it's not frozen anymore, you have a lot of problems. You know, you have erosion, and you just have a lot less sturdy land. And then you also have sea levels rising, and you have bigger storms that mean that every time that there's a rainstorm or a snowstorm, it can claim a little bit more of the land. So if you take a boat out of any of these little communities, you can just see the land sloughing off into the ocean. It's really like someone took a guillotine blade and just cut off pieces of the land.
The villagers in Nutok voted to move to another piece of land about 9 miles away. They voted in 1996. What has happened since?
They have picked another piece of land, and they have built a little bit there. There are a few homes. There's a half-finished community center. But it's really hard to get to it because there are no roads. So they have to take boats there. There's no landing strip. It's kind of a catch-22 where a lot of the government agencies will say, we'll come in and build something once there's a community there. You know, we'll build a school once there are kids there. We'll build a post office once there are people there who are getting mail. But no one wants to live there if there's no school and no post office. So they're just kind of waiting. And they've been waiting for a really long time. And, you know, President Obama visited Alaska this summer and talked about some of these villages that are similar to Nutok that are facing these problems. And, you know, even with all of that attention, nothing has really changed since then.
So do you think there is a way to move forward for these villagers, or what's going to happen?
I think they would say they need a lot more money, but it's kind of unclear where they would get money from because it's not really a cash-based society. It's a society that's built on, you know, hunting, gathering, living off the land. And there's not a whole lot of industry there and not a whole lot of way for people to come up with the money to move their house or move their community to a completely different location.
How much time is left? What are the predictions in terms of when this community as it stands now will be gone?
I think it really depends on the weather and how bad the storms are in the next couple of years. I mean, I think scientists have said that with a really bad storm, the school, which is near the edge of the village and is really the only place in the town with running water, with bathrooms, with showers, with a lot of electricity, the school could be underwater by 2017, which obviously is very soon. That might not happen depending on the weather and how quickly the permafrost melts. It might happen sooner. So, you know, there really is increasing urgency as people in the town and people in Alaska look at predictions and say, you know what, this date that seemed like a long time away a couple years ago is just about here.
Do you think this issue is going to pick up more steam on a national level as this happens to more and more communities in different parts of the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the country is going to need to decide what approach it wants to take. I mean, on the one hand, it's very difficult for the government to come in and say to different people, you need to move, this community can't stay here anymore. On the other hand, it's very hard to look at communities, you know, such as New Orleans, areas on the East Coast that are flooded time and time again, and FEMA has to come in and help people rebuild, and it can just be a very costly and challenging proposition. So I think, you know, before we say we're going to move all these communities or we're not going to move all these communities, local areas and the country is going to have to decide what are we going to do about these communities that are really threatened by climate change, and how can we help them figure out what's next.
Thank you so much, Alana.
Thanks for having me.
Alana Samuels is a staff writer for The Atlantic. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. A lot of our discussions about communities threatened by climate change revolve around big storms. Superstorm Sandy delivered a major wake-up call to the eastern seaboard 3 years ago. It left the New Jersey coastline in ruins, and the focus quickly turned to recovery. How would these communities rebuild? But another big question is, how will the state prepare for the next Sandy? Reporter Joe Hernandez visited the Jersey Shore and found that the debate over coastal protection is far from settled.
Sandy was one of those watershed moments for New Jersey. Residents and officials realized they had to come together and make it a priority to protect the coastline along the Atlantic Ocean from future storms, right?
Not as much as I would have liked.
Brad Smith is an environmental field specialist with Stockton University's Coastal Research Center, which partners with the state on projects to monitor the coastline.
I expected there to be a consensus out there that dunes and shore protection features are important and worth having in place.
But Smith was left disappointed. Coastal management became a contentious issue after Sandy, in part because the scientific community itself didn't always agree on the best methods. One strategy is to create what's called a living shoreline. That's using natural elements to strengthen the coast, such as pumping more sand onto the beach or building artificial sand dunes. Another is to build what are called hard structures, things like wooden or cement seawalls and rock jetties. Smith says there's no one-size-fits-all plan for every beach in New Jersey.
It's very area-specific. Some areas would say yes, maybe you need a hard structure, but generally, if you build a dune to the standards that, the core sets, that would be more than adequate. But, some places need that, some places don't. Some places are entirely unmanaged.
And that idea, that coastal management strategies can change depending where along the coast you're standing, can make it difficult for everybody involved to agree. After Sandy, the federal government spent hundreds of millions of dollars on beach protection projects in New Jersey. The state and the Army Corps of Engineers got right to work building dunes and seawalls from Cape May in the south to Union Beach up north. But some towns that were skeptical of whether these projects would actually benefit local residents started saying no.
I continue to be frustrated, and I speak only for myself, but I continue to be frustrated by the opposition of some folks in this state to us completing the dune system.
That was Governor Chris Christie speaking at a press conference this month on Hurricane Joaquin, which ended up turning out to sea and sparing New Jersey any serious damage. He says opponents of the dune project are only out to preserve their oceanfront views, and that refusing the dunes endangers their lives and the lives of people in nearby towns. One high-profile example of opposition to dunes has been the town of Margate, an affluent community of more than 6,000 people just south of Atlantic City.
And so I'll say again, quite candidly, to towns like Margate, you are amongst the most selfish people in the state of New Jersey. And if this hurricane had come to shore, the damage that would have been done to lives and property in Margate, I hope it's worth the vanity act that you're all engaging in.
But in Margate, the story is a little different. Dan Gottlieb is one of the residents behind the group Margate Citizens Questioning the Beach Project, which has been fighting the dune proposal for 3 years. He says one thing many people don't know about Margate is that it's had a seawall along its beach for decades, which Gottlieb says makes an additional sand dune unnecessary.
It appears to me that that's a more robust structure that stands 7 feet high and is made with big, thick pieces of wood that are anchored by pilings that go deep into the sand, it would be a lot more difficult to wash that away than it would be to wash a pile of sand away.
And a majority of the town agrees. Margate residents voted in two separate referendums to fight the state on its dune project there. Gottlieb readily admits he's no geologist, but says living in Margate his whole life has given him a perspective the state doesn't have. He says the state is focusing on the beach, where there's already protection, but ignoring the other side of the island along the bay, where homes quickly flooded during Sandy.
I wish they would sit down and come to some type of compromise, some type of negotiation, where the resources that are being thrown at trying to push the ocean back are thrown at maybe trying to keep the bay from coming up over the back bay seawalls.
So while there might not be consensus about how to manage the coastline, there seems to be agreement that something needs to be done to protect coastal towns. Since Sandy, state and federal agencies have spent $560 million on beach protection projects in New Jersey. That number is expected to jump to $1.3 billion total after additional projects get underway. But will dunes and seawalls and pump stations be enough? Princeton climate scientist Michael Oppenheimer is not convinced.
If the world keeps warming and sea level keeps rising, this is a fight that the ocean is going to win.
Oppenheimer says the first priority should really be reducing greenhouse gas emissions in an attempt to slow or stop sea level rise. But he says what's more practical is for New Jersey to think less about short-term fixes and more about the complex and costly projects that have been successful in protecting coastal towns. One example he cites is a series of huge dam-like surge barriers that the United Kingdom built on the River Thames, which cost billions of dollars and took decades to build. Oppenheimer says the United States just doesn't have the right mindset.
It's not clear that even those solutions, which are big and expensive but work to some extent, are feasible because we're sitting around just sort of daydreaming while the Earth is warming and the sea is rising.
And it may take another Superstorm Sandy to wake us up. For The Pulse, I'm Joe Hernandez.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. We heard a lot about the new guidelines from the American Cancer Society on breast cancer screenings this week, and the gist is start mammograms later and get them less often. This has created a lot of confusion among women because different organizations are recommending different things, and we're about to complicate things a little bit further here. In recent years, it's become clear that even if you go for a routine mammogram, dense breast tissue can camouflage cancerous spots. About half of all U.S. states have laws that require doctors to tell patients if they have dense breasts, and federal legislation is currently under review. But experts are divided about whether mandatory notification laws are saving lives or prompting unnecessary tests. Karen Chakurji reports.
Cindy Olmsted was about to have major surgery. She had found a cancerous lump in her breast and scheduled a mastectomy right away. Even though she lives in Ohio, she was getting her care at a hospital in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
When I was laying on the gurney waiting to have my breast removed, our neighbor from Ohio came to wish me well, and he brought us all our mail.
At the time, Olmsted was 60 years old. She had been through a long, terrible journey of tests and biopsies and false alarms. But eventually, she could feel a lump herself. A biopsy confirmed the diagnosis, and Olmsted was ready for surgery.
And I opened the mail because there was a letter from Breast Diagnostic Center there. And the letter said, "We are pleased to inform you that we have found no evidence of cancer in your breast." This is when I'm sitting 30 feet from the operating room waiting to get my breast taken off.
She was shocked.
The doctor's biopsy came back positive for cancer. The mammogram the same week came back negative for cancer.
Although she didn't know it at the time, Olmsted had something called dense breast tissue. It's pretty common. About half of women have this at some point in their lives. But back when Olmsted was going through all this, she didn't hear anyone talk about it, even though she's a journalist who has written in-depth reports on breast cancer.
Had I known that I had heterogeneously dense breasts, at the time all this happened, I maybe would have changed my course of treatment. I may have gone for a second opinion sooner.
So what this is
Dr. Lori Margulies is the director of breast imaging at the Dubin Breast Center at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. She's sitting on a stool in front of three large computer screens in the mammography reading room. It's dark and quiet. The white tissue on the x-rays is lighting up our little nook.
So most cancer spots show up as white. So what does dense breast tissue look like? White. So we're looking for white on white.
She's pulled up an example of dense breasts. They're filled with white, cloudy-looking tissue.
In a patient like this, however, the breast tissue has become denser. There's more white. So if there's a cancer here, it can easily hide behind some of this white tissue.
Years ago, Margulies says, nobody was really talking about breast density.
And that all changed in the state of Connecticut when there was a woman named Nancy Capella who was found to have breast cancer not long after a negative normal mammogram. And she started investigating why this was so. And her doctor said, well, you have dense breasts. You could have found it earlier, perhaps, with an ultrasound. And she said, but I didn't know.
Capello set out on a mission to change that. She founded a nonprofit called Are You Dense and started advocating for a law that would require doctors to tell patients if they have dense breast tissue. Now, 6 years later, some version of this law exists in 24 states and bills are pending in 9 more. Plus, a federal bill was just reintroduced earlier this year. But despite this growing movement, there's still some unresolved questions.
Having the information about your breast density is not the problem. The problem then becomes what to do about it. Is it right to do the supplemental tests? Is it important to do it? How it's done? Where is it done? Who does it? What do you biopsy? Do you biopsy everything that you see or only things that are super suspicious? And I think that's part of a national learning curve.
Some see notification as a way to catch more cancers, but others say it might send the wrong message. Among them is Dr. Jennifer Haas, a professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. She says that legislation is well-intentioned but misleading.
It tries to suggest that additional testing may decrease some of that uncertainty, but it really doesn't do that. It really doesn't provide additional resolution for women beyond what their initial test suggested.
Ha says there's little evidence to date that telling women about breast density is saving more lives.
It's really diverting attention from other issues. So I think it would be really ideal if we could do a better job of educating women about their risk overall, of which density is one medium-sized risk factor.
As for Cindy Olmsted, who had had the mastectomy, she wishes her doctors had told her about breast density. This summer, she celebrated 5 years of being cancer-free. And today, her home state of Ohio does have a mandatory notification law. The federal bill is lingering in the Senate Health Committee. For The Pulse, I'm Karen Chakurji.
I'm Maiken Scott. You're listening to The Pulse, and we're going to move on to another issue in women's health. Giving birth to a child for the first time is a big step into the unknown. You can try to prepare for it, do breathing exercises, take birthing classes, vow not to get an epidural. But when the big moment comes, you'll be going along for whatever ride is happening. When she was a few days past her due date with her first child, Maggie Mitchell from Westchester, Pennsylvania, noticed the baby's movements had decreased. She was worried and went to the hospital where she was induced to begin labor. But things didn't progress over the course of a long day, and the baby's heart rate was dropping after each contraction, which worried doctors. Shortly before midnight, things got a lot more dramatic. This was 5 years ago, and a lot has happened since. Maggie told us about it for our series, Patient Files.
My OB came running in. It got very harried and very scary. Came running in and said, I don't like this anymore. We need to get you in for a C-section. So that is a blur. Nurses were running around. They were trying to get my husband prepped into scrubs because he was coming into the OR with me. They took me into the OR. It was a little after midnight. At that point, a nurse took my husband. She said, "Dad, come with me," and took him out of the OR, and I was put under general. So that was it. So I wasn't awake. I wasn't moving anywhere. I had a cesarean section under general anesthesia at 28 years old with my very first baby. It was terrifying. I woke up, I don't know how long, you know, later after that, and was told that I had a baby girl. We didn't know what we were having. And it was just, it was a very odd feeling because everybody says, "Oh, I had my baby. It was the best day of my life." And I felt like I just had surgery that I wasn't expecting. I just had emergency surgery. And I distinctly remember telling my mom and dad the day that Evie was born, "I'm never having another baby," because it was so opposite and so scary. And I thought, why would I ever do this to myself again? I felt like I didn't have her, that she was born, but it wasn't a mother and child type of thing. I missed her birth. That's how I felt. And I have a picture of the first time I held her, but I don't remember that. You know, I had always pictured myself having more than one child, but immediately I thought, no. So let's see. My daughter turned 4 in 2014, and right before her 4th birthday, I got pregnant. And I hired a doula, and I was just going whole hog. I was going to have this vaginal birth after cesarean. Everything was going great. I was feeling good, a pretty uneventful pregnancy. And then just a couple, like about a week before my due date, I had an ultrasound, and the baby we saw was so big. He was going to be, they thought, 8 or 9 pounds. They're 8 or 9 pounds. And because I had never really labored with my daughter, I had never pushed, all of a sudden, the doula and the OB and I sort of agreed that maybe a C-section would be safest and best. And I didn't know, because I didn't know what my body was going to do, because I had never really labored before. I already had a child. It was a week before Christmas. I thought, really, what is my goal here? Is my goal to have a healthy delivery of the baby, or is it to prove some kind of a point that I can do this? And it was ultimately to have a healthy baby, you know, and a healthy me. So I scheduled a C-section, which I swore that I would never, ever do again. I was having really painful contractions leading up to the scheduled C-section. So I knew that my body was ready. It was doing something. And we went to the hospital on Friday morning. I was prepped. I was in the waiting area. The medication worked great. I felt no pain at all. And I was, you know, the result was this beautiful baby boy. And I felt immediately at peace. I felt totally peaceful. I felt happy. I knew that that was the best thing that I ever could have decided to do. And a surgery that had 4 years before left me so empty and questioning so many things and so angry, I did the same thing, and it had the completely opposite effect.
Maggie Mitchell of Westchester, Pennsylvania, with her son Leo sitting on her lap and her daughter Evelyn in the control room, Maggie was telling us about her 2 C-section experiences. And if you have a story you want to share with us for our series Patient Files, please email us. We're at thepulse@whyy.org. The World Health Organization says the rate of medically necessary C-sections is between 10 and 15% of births. In the U.S., roughly 32% of babies are born via C-sections. So this means major surgery for the mother that perhaps could have been avoided and a lot of additional costs. Hospitals are coming under pressure to release their C-section data. And one hospital in California was flat out told by one large insurance company, cut down your C-sections, or we will cut you from the network. Joining us now to talk about that is Dr. Amy Van Blaricom. She's an OBGYN at Hoag Memorial Hospital Presbyterian in Orange County, California. Amy, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
In 2012, your hospital's C-section rate was at about 38%. What did your organization do to reduce that rate?
Well, at that point, we had begun collecting some data from the CMQCC, which is the California Quality Metrics Board that is based in San Francisco. And we began by releasing the data for individual providers throughout the hospital so we could see how our department laid out across the percentages. So we knew that there were some doctors that were particularly high percentages of cesarean sections, and then we saw that there were some doctors that were very low. And this was blinded data at first. After a period of time, about a year of releasing the blinded data and reviewing it in our department meetings and discussing the fact that our department's C-section rate was higher than the state average and that we really needed to make some changes in that regard, we started releasing the unblinded data, which revealed which physicians had which percentage rates. And that was pretty controversial at the time.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, how did that go over? How did you feel about it?
Personally, I felt okay about it. I was the chair of the department at the time, and my data looked pretty good, actually. I was already kind of right at slightly below the state average for my own data. And I will say that it was not well received by the majority of the department members. Many of our physicians felt as if it was a punitive type of thing where they were being publicly reprimanded for having higher data without really the background of why their numbers were the way they were.
Tell me about the decision-making process that happens before a C-section, kind of what paves the road toward a C-section.
Right. Well, there are really two main reasons to perform a cesarean section. One is for maternal reasons, and those include things like the labor pattern is very prolonged. You know, they've been in labor too long. The baby isn't progressing through the birth canal at a normal rate. Or there are medical complications of pregnancy that require that the baby be delivered faster than a routine labor and vaginal delivery would allow, things like high blood pressure or diabetes, those kinds of things. And then there are fetal indications. So if, for example, the mother is in the process of labor and the baby is showing signs of distress, then, you know, that we would want to have the baby delivered sooner than potentially the process of labor would allow. So that could require a cesarean section as well.
And where are the opportunities for the doctor to perhaps help avoid a C-section?
The opportunity in lowering a C-section rate really, I think, is in that area where maybe there's a situation where the patient has been in labor for a little while, but everything else looks normal. The baby is doing fine. The mother is doing fine. And there really is the option of waiting a little bit longer, seeing if Mother Nature does it on her own, rather than having the first inclination be to proceed to a cesarean section.
Do you get nervous about this sometimes? The pressure is very high. The stakes are incredibly high. If something happens, you'll be on the hook, and people will say to you, how could you ever let this happen?
Yes, I would say that that is a significant area of concern for many OBGYNs. You know, the saying is, you never regret the cesarean section you did, you regret the cesarean section you didn't do. And there are tremendous pressures on obstetricians these days from a liability perspective. And so I do think that many of us have a lower threshold to make an intervention because we're concerned. We're concerned about liability. We're concerned about how that baby's going to do. And that's a lot of pressure when you're being pushed from the other side of things by the hospital or by the insurance company to decrease cost, to not do what they would consider unnecessary surgery. And I think these kinds of pressures lead to the controversy, and it definitely opened up a significant conversation in our department when we started revealing this data.
Amy, thank you so much for talking with me.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
Amy Van Blaricombe is an OBGYN at Hoag Memorial Hospital Presbyterian in Orange County, California. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mikan Scott. For almost 100 years, Band-Aids have been the go-to treatment for small cuts, scrapes, and skinned knees. Billions of them have helped ward off infections and reduce healing time. But bigger injuries, like those suffered by soldiers, for example, need a better solution. That has led researchers on a quest for a smart Band-Aid. The Pulse's Todd Bookman went inside a Cambridge laboratory to learn more.
There are laboratories all over the country, all over the world, in fact, working on different types of smart bandages. Here at Harvard, Brian Hsu is putting his PhD in chemistry to use on next-generation gauze.
So the treated bandage looks just like a regular cotton gauze.
Hsu holds up a few inches of the material. It's white, a bit transparent.
It's fairly flexible, a little bit stiffer, just because it has this thin polymer coating on it, but very lightweight and very stable.
The polymer coating is made up of layers of nanofibers, which get sprayed onto the gauze using an ultra-fine mist. They contain a special series of amino acids, one of the building blocks of the human body.
Nanofibers are based off of something that was observed in nature. They're synthetically made, but completely biodegradable and non-toxic.
The nanofibers, which were developed at MIT, remain on the gauze until coming into contact with a wound. The presence of liquid, in this case blood, causes them to release. They then act as a coagulant, speeding up the clotting process. And all of this happens on a nanoscale. Each individual fiber is 10,000 times thinner than a strand of human hair.
Yeah, let me show you some pictures of what these things look like on a microscopic scale, because sometimes that helps people visualize what's going on.
Hsu pulls up images on his computer screen.
You can see that they look like spaghetti that's entangled spaghetti.
The strands of nanofibers snarl the flowing blood cells. They look like big meatballs caught in a net. In animal testing, the nanofiber-coated gauze stopped blood flow from a wound in 2 minutes, compared to 5 minutes for traditional gauze. There are already other products on the market that claim to slow bleeding, but Hsu and colleagues are working on bandages that do something more. The goal is to build a multi-layered gauze that also seeps out an antibacterial drug and a painkiller, an all-in-one first aid kit. That type of bandage could help soldiers who endure a bullet or shrapnel injury in the field. It's not easy, though, to get the various medicines to release at the correct rate.
You know, each type of drug is different. Their chemical structure is different. Their properties are different. And their stability is different. So making something that can release a drug with the release profile or the timing that you want can be challenging.
Other laboratories are taking smart bandages in different directions. At UC Berkeley, researchers are using ultra-thin sensors to detect bed sores before they break through the skin surface. Another early-stage device monitors oxygen and temperature inside a wound, alerting doctors to potential infection.
A lot of people are trying to do similar things. They're all looking at different strategies. Some are really, really good compared to the rest, but that's from a research and academic perspective. From the industrial perspective, it might be, okay, which one is more cost-effective, which can be manufactured more easily, which isn't on patent that we can use, right?
Brian Hsu says we're still likely years away from any of these complex products making it through the regulatory process. Even with the long horizon, it must be interesting to work on something so revolutionary.
Is it? That's great. I mean, I looked at that stuff for years, right? So for me, it's just like an average day kind of thing.
Sorry, Brian. Doing research down on the nanoscale is decidedly far from average. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. From updating an old treatment with technology to a story about old remedies possibly making a comeback in modern medicine, researchers in Louisiana are investigating if Cajun and Creole healing traditions, like using lizard's tail in fighting inflammation, could play a role in treating one of America's most pressing health issues. Travis Lux reports from Baton Rouge.
On a piece of land along the Atchafalaya River, Larry Alon is collecting plants.
That's Apios americana root. You can eat it raw, but they're better cooked. Yeah.
What's it taste like?
A starchy potato. Potato is the chicken of the vegetable world. We could make supper.
But we're not here to make supper. We're here for science. Alon is a botanist for the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wetlands Research Center. And he's part of a new study out of Pennington Biomedical Research Center investigating the healing potential of native Louisiana plants. The goal of this study is to figure out whether any of the plants used in Cajun and Creole folk medicines might be helpful for treating diabetes. Generally, you might not expect folk medicine and modern medicine to work together like this. But that might be the thing about the study that excites Ray Brasseur the most. He's an anthropologist with the University of Louisiana Lafayette.
You know, it requires a certain amount of respect for traditional knowledge. And that is not always how science works, because in a lot of ways, and especially during the 20th century at different times, science has tried to replace traditional knowledge. But as a result, a whole lot of knowledge has just been thrown to the side. And now, some people are believing that there's a value in taking another look.
One of the plants they're taking another look at today is the lizard's tail. Here's Larry Alon again.
It's just a common wetland plant and easy to find, generally grows in the shade.
Lizard's tail has this stalk of teeny white flowers that gradually taper toward the end, sort of resembling the proportions of a lizard's tail. It was sought by Cajuns and Creoles for its anti-inflammatory properties, and it would have been either steeped into a tea or applied directly to wounds. Once back in his lab, Alon will send the sample of lizard's tail to collaborators at Rutgers University. The folks at Rutgers will prepare an extract from that sample and then send the extract to Anique Boudreau, who works at Pennington Biomedical.
And then we do the experiments on the actual cells here in the lab. In our case, what we're looking for are effects on insulin signaling.
In other words,
things that are related to diabetes.
But it's not easy work. For one, plants are pretty chemically complicated. There can be thousands of compounds in a given plant sample. And the chemical makeup can change with the seasons, even for the same plant.
You know, that complexity makes things difficult in a way, but it also means that there's a huge potential there.
And they've been pretty happy with their results so far. Overall, they've tested about 100 extracts, and about 10% of those may be effective. It's still early in the process, though, so she's quick to add this caveat.
When I say that it was effective in increasing insulin-mediated AKT phosphorylation in a context of insulin resistance in this particular muscle cell line that's growing in a dish.
So what does that mean?
We're at the very, very beginning here. It's effective in treating diabetes.
But due to the fact that the National Institute of Health recently renewed funding for Pennington's study, the research is poised to continue for at least 5 more years. For The Pulse, I'm Travis Lux.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Tanine Dariush is our intern, Charlie Kyer, our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson is the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. And we have just a few tickets left for our Bill Nye event at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia on November 9th. You can purchase tickets at whyy.org/events. And if you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.